please don't make me feel like a disaster. I'm learning how to put the pieces back together and turn the aching to composure. That's the Wonder Years. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Nice win yesterday, 6-2. Jays have a big eighth inning to turn that one around. Justin Turner has his second three-hit game in a row. Vlad homers for the fifth time in six games. Another really good Yariel Rodriguez start. Some good relief appearances from Chad Green and Jimmy Garcia. If you're an opposing team, maybe looking to add to your bullpen over the next couple of days. That downer lyric off the top, though, is, hey, we're a couple days out from the trade deadline here. And as much as we like talking about the trades, this also needs to be framed as you're starting to do the work for 2025 as well. What does that look like? Should you be doing the work for 2025? Should you be taking a bigger deadline swing here? That's kind of the tone of today's show. We're going to talk to JP Ricciardi a little later in the show. We'll have Chris Black on as well. But joining us now to start things off, our good pal from The Score, Jonah Bierenbaum. Jonah, terrific hair day. How we doing?
I'm doing well, brother. How are you? It's good to be back.
Yeah. How was your trip? So for anyone who doesn't know, Jonah hasn't been on the show in a while because he spent a couple weeks traveling all around Africa.
Yeah, it was amazing, man. Really the trip of a lifetime. We started in Zambia, made our way down to Botswana, where we went on safari. From there, we headed on to Zimbabwe and then circled back to Zambia to catch our extremely indirect journey home. But it was unbelievable, man, between the natural beauty, the big game that we saw, and just, you know, being immersed in a completely different culture. It was the trip of a lifetime, dude. Highly recommend.
And now you get to come back and you get to watch a Blue Jays team that's in the exact same spot as when you left. I imagine you didn't, like, I know you, and if the Jays were in a really good spot, if the record was reversed, they were 10 games over 500, they were in a playoff spot, you probably would have, like, at a minimum, box scores after, but you would have been trying to do the data thing on safari, like, hey, elephant, check out this Vlad home run. Did you check out a little bit, given where things are?
I did, but to your earlier point, were the Jays in a position where they were contending for an AL East title? I'm kiboshing the trip, man. I'm just breaking it to my girlfriend. I'm sorry, babe, but, you know, Africa's always going to be there. How often are the Jays going to be enjoying a 10-game lead atop the AL East in July?
Yeah, how often? Never. Never is the answer to that, apparently. We're going to do some bigger picture stuff, but let's talk about the game that was last night. And I think the headline item for this game, and potentially the headline item for the rest of 2024 in terms of what matters, what are we building toward in terms of 2025, is the performance of Yariel Rodriguez. He goes 5 2/3 yesterday, gives up two. One of those was an inherited runner. I guess first, I'm sure there is a component of this that is he was at 73 pitches. We're not going to let him throw 105. He's already into the sixth inning. We only want him to throw 100 this year, et cetera. What did you make of not letting him go with Brandon Lowe there, given how well he'd pitched?
Yeah, I was surprised. You know, it's not like he was in trouble. His mix all night, his sequencing, his command had all been outstanding. He had allowed very little hard contact. And 73 pitches just frankly isn't that high. It's considerably lower than his season high. And you know, given all the time he spent on the injured list, he's not really in jeopardy of running his innings count too high this season. So I was a little bit surprised, given how well he had performed all evening long, that John Schneider didn't give him a slightly longer leash. But, you know, given that they're taking a prudent approach now and looking ahead towards 2025, I get erring on the side of caution and not overextending a guy who could be a key piece of your rotation moving forwards in an effectively meaningless game in late July.
And this is a bit of a conundrum, like deadline sellers, whatever, eye toward 2025. We've got a whole bunch of baseball left to watch, right? And the better Yariel Rodriguez pitches, the more we're going to want to see him out there. But the better Yariel Rodriguez pitches, the stronger the logic for, like, hey, we probably shouldn't gear him up too far. And, like, look, there were some really great comments from Brian Bannister to James Fegan the other day about pitcher load and injuries. And obviously this is we don't have the answers and things like that, but one of their leading theories with the White Sox, and this was in the context of Garrett Crochet and his innings load and things like that, but the, some of Brian Bannister's thoughts were effectively the hardest part is the deloading of a pitcher and then having him after 5-6 months off load back up. That's why you see guys like Jordan Romano, who got a late start, struggle. Jordan Montgomery, Blake Snell, those kind of guys, because it's that reloading phase that's so difficult. That, to me, you know, if you believe in that, is an argument for you want Yariel pitching deeper into September. But they told us coming into the year, 80 to 100 innings-ish. He's already at 60 and a third if you include his AAA time. Now, how much of that they count as the same because it was rehab starts, et cetera. But I could absolutely see a scenario where Yoriel Rodriguez is capped around 80 pitches the rest of the way because they're not competing for anything and they want to. I think it's probably more important to keep him going until September than, you know, have him go seven innings, 100 pitches here and there. How do you feel about the way they might use him the rest of the way?
Yeah, I think that's about right. And look, I don't think he's eclipsed 85 pitches in any single start this year. They are obviously being very intentional, very cautious with him, given just how little he has pitched in the years leading up to this season. However, I will note that on the broadcast last night, Dan Schulman was kind of projecting out the remaining workload for Yoriel Rodriguez, and he kind of speculated that maybe he could get up as high as, you know, 110, 120 innings for the season, which does seem ambitious, admittedly, given, you know, there's only 2 months left, so maybe a dozen more starts. I get it. I get them taking the long view at this point. There really is, no need to see him, you know, ramp it up to a point where he's, you know, even running the risk of potentially, compromising the amount of volume that he can log next year. So, you know, I get it. Obviously, in the heat of the moment, you know, last night when he's only at 73 pitches, and given how well he's pitched, you're maybe hoping that he gets a little bit more leash. But I understand the approach, even if I don't necessarily agree with it on a micro level game to game.
Yeah, and look, in terms of the innings load, like, we're past the era of the Verducci effect, right? Like, we're not doing innings pitch plus 25 the next year and things like that. The team has data on so much more. Yoriel Rodriguez is going to dictate a lot of this by how he feels, right? Like, hey, back feels great, stuff feels great, I want to keep pitching, I feel strong. So the combination of, yeah, the innings and the pitches, but also what they're seeing behind the scenes, what Yoriel is saying and feeling, this is a, you know, kind of a fluid target. The more important takeaway here, of course, is that, Jonah, we're talking about all this stuff because Yoriel Rodriguez has been very good. He's got a 360 ERA, over 10 starts, and yeah, only 40 innings. He hasn't gone super deep, but those are really strong results, and certainly strong in terms of building on that and improving for the future. This is a team that is going to have, at minimum, one starting rotation spot to fill, probably more than that. Where... Like, is Yoriel Rodriguez, when we look at what matters over these last 61 games, is how Yoriel Rodriguez looks and performs number one for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, Yusei Kikuchi is gone. Alek Manoah, who knows how available he's going to be next season. Yoriel Rodriguez is effectively auditioning for a full-time spot in the Blue Jays rotation in 2025. And if what we saw last night and really have seen since the start of July is even close to a true indication of who Yoriel Rodriguez is and what he's capable of, he could be one of the massive steals of Ross Atkins' tenure as general manager and a huge asset for this Blue Jays team moving forward. You mentioned his ERA for the season, which is obviously very strong. He now has a 2.01 ERA in four July starts, and his fielding independent pitching this month is the exact same as Paul Skeens. Oh. Now, obviously, his profile is a little bit different, but last night's performance is a stark illustration of what he can do when he's commanding all five of his pitches, which is that he can flummox hitters from both sides of the plate and miss both barrels and bats. Righty, lefty, it didn't matter last night. He allowed very little hard contact, only four balls with an exit velocity above 95 miles an hour, and two of them were pounded into the ground. And in addition to that, he managed a 32% called strike and whiff rate, which is his highest mark since his season and MLB debut. And while he didn't generate a ton of swinging strikes, he did set a new season high in called strikes, which I think is a reflection of how well he was sequencing and how well he was locating. And he still managed six strikeouts.
Yeah.
So all in all, it was just a terrific outing. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, his innings count notwithstanding and the team's cautious approach notwithstanding, I was surprised that John Schneider yanked him after 73 pitches. But, you really couldn't be more encouraged from what we've seen from Yoriel Rodriguez lately. And it really looks like he's positioning himself to be not just a member, but a key member of the Blue Jays rotation in 2025 and beyond.
And, man, just so fun to watch, too. The intensity level, the, like, I'm changing my leg kick, I'm changing my arm slot. Makes it harder to evaluate, but, it's a lot of fun. And to your point about those July numbers, you know, maybe more encouraging than any of the swing and miss called strike stuff and things like that. That's the third time in those four starts he's gotten into the sixth inning and gone deep into the sixth inning, if not further. So, you know, one of the things that was in his early starts and certainly in his AAA rehab starts, pitch efficiency wasn't there, right? If you're talking about he's only going to be able to go 75 pitches, we were talking about four innings flat for a good chunk of his early season. So that's really encouraging as well. And that's the other thing to keep in mind with an innings load is not all innings are created equal. If you're throwing 10-pitch innings, he could probably go to 120, 130 innings because they're not as, high load innings or high intensity innings necessarily. The other thing that happened in this game that was, it's not the only other thing. Justin Turner having three hits, two games in a row, a couple days out from the deadline feels like helpful timing. But Vlad homered for the fifth time in six games. It's been an interesting year of, Vlad struggled a lot at the start. And then the contact hitting profile really came along and you liked the approach. You liked him spitting on those low and away breaking balls that were just off the plate. The discipline and the eye seemed to come back. But there was this a little bit of power would be nice. A little bit of power would be nice. His slugging percentage is now up to .488, which would be the second highest of his career. He now has 18 home runs. Fangraphs projects him to finish with 29, which would be, not quite 2022 level, but a reasonable number of home runs. What have you seen from Vlad during this power surge? Is it just as simple as, he was locked in and with how hard he hits the ball, the home runs were going to come eventually, even if they're all dead center.
I think so. But I think it also comes down to swing decisions too. I think he's being more selective, both in the zone and refusing to chase, like we've seen in the past. But that's the thing is that, given the StatCast profile, given how hard he hits the ball on a regular basis, it would make sense that if he's being a little bit more selective and choosing pitches that he can elevate, that he would deliver more power. It's consistent with, all the other components of his swing and of who he is as a hitter. I just think it's a matter of locking in swing decision-wise, approach-wise, and then doing, what he does, which is hit the ball hard. When you choose the right pitch to swing at, when you hit the ball hard, you have a better chance of elevating it, of doing damage, and of putting together really an incredible run of power hitting.
It's been a lot of fun. And I mean, it's better to be doing this conversation when he's hitting really well and the power's coming, but he remains like a very perplexing guy to project forward. I think we've seen the floor. The floor was last year where, he's only going to be about 15, 20% better than league average at the plate. And that's not super helpful as a first base DH. Fascinating. Like, this is the second best season of his career now. And his season line this year is actually in line with the second half of his 2021 MVP campaign. That says more, I think, about the first half to second half drop off in that MVP campaign than anything. He's hitting really well. I don't know, man. He's a fascinating guy to project forward.
He is enigmatic, to say the least, man. And it's a real conundrum for the Blue Jays front office because I tweeted about this earlier this week. Vlad, since the start of 2022, has racked up less wins above replacement than the likes of Brandon Marsh and Ryan McMahon, guys who are not household names. And yet, if the Blue Jays were to approach him today with a 10-year extension offer worth $250 million, which, to be clear, would be the largest contract ever given to a first baseman, I feel like he'd turn it down. I feel like he would turn that down and take his chances in free agency.
But you probably can't go much higher than that, right? If you're the at least right now.
I wouldn't think so. That's the thing. I think ultimately finding a mutually agreeable valuation point is not going to be possible between now and when he hits the open market. I think the likelihood of extending him is probably quite low because the Blue Jays aren't going to want to sign him to a Rafael Devers-esque contract where he's getting more than $330 million when he's a first baseman who in 6 years at the big league level has had one truly elite season. But that, I guess, really leads me into my other point, which is that, and look, I promise you I take no pleasure in being a blow-it-up guy and ultimately conceding that this era of Blue Jays baseball was a failure, but I don't believe that this group can realistically contend for a World Series in 2025. I just think the core pieces are too volatile. The likelihood of continued regression from the rotation is very high. The bullpen largely needs to be fortified, if not rebuilt. And so, given the current talent base at the major league level, the key subtractions coming in the near term, and the dismal state of the farm system, I do think it makes more sense for the Blue Jays to trade Vlad for a Hall of Prospects than try to extend him and to extend him on a deal that they would almost certainly be uncomfortable with. And look, that sucks. It sucks. But I worry that if the Blue Jays extend him, they're running the risk of turning into the Angels, who extended Mike Trout in 2019 to what was then the biggest contract in baseball history. They haven't been a winning team since. Well, I mean, they haven't been a winning team for almost a decade. And that's not because they extended Mike Trout. It's because they have failed developmentally in a way that evokes the current Blue Jays.
So that's where maybe I hit pause on this. And I think there's a good case to, you know, do what you're saying. Like, hey, the Seattle Mariners desperately need offense. They have like 8 prospects in the top 100 and not the deepest system, but like their system runs 15, 16, 20 deep. You know, in terms of like 40 plus to 45 future value guys and higher.
Just to add to that, the Milwaukee Brewers, who are going to be without Christian Yelich potentially for the remainder of the season, they have the second best farm system in baseball. And on top of that, this is a market that is largely devoid of impact hitters and especially controllable impact hitters.
Yeah.
And I just want to continue on sort of what I was alluding to earlier, which is that what is also informing this approach is that, or this perspective rather, is that Vlad isn't Mike Trout, right? If Vlad was putting up 8 to 10 WAR per year, I would be lobbying hard for an extension over a trade, but he isn't. He's a first baseman who over the last 3 seasons has lower isolated power than Hunter Renfroe and Rowdy Tellez. Remember him? He may or may not be a franchise player, but regardless, I know there's a contender out there who will value him as one and would be inclined to part with tremendous amounts of prospect capital to have Vlad anchoring their lineup for the next 2 pennant races.
And this is why we, you know, the reporting from our own people here at Sportsnet, the reporting from national people around baseball is not that Vlad is untouchable. It's that you'd have to be blown away to engage in that kind of conversation. And there's a blown away point somewhere. Like this front office is looking at this right now. And you know, this is what I likely think the perspective is okay, well, we have the window until 2025. We have jobs on the line. We have seats to fill. We're not the White Sox, Angels, Rockies level of bad. We, and everyone has it. Like, look at how bad the AL looks right now. Like, it's not going to be impossible for a team to turn it around and be pretty good again. If you have 60, 70 million to spend, you make a couple shrewd trades. I'm not suggesting that's the likeliest outcome for this team in this front office, but you could see why they would think that way. However, they're also probably thinking that with in the back of their minds. And if it doesn't work early in 2025, we still have that blow it up button to hit because Vlad as a rental, Bo as a rental, the veteran pitchers. Now, obviously those guys lose their value between now and then. So that is to say you have to, an offer for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. not only has to be a good, or Bo Bichette or any of the veteran pitchers or whatever, not only has to be solid in terms of the value coming back, but you basically have to buy out the Jays. That's that percentage chance that the Jays could run it back and spend in free agency and be good again next year. And even if you don't think that's like a 100% likely thing, you have to buy out that possibility from this front office because, you know, their jobs are on the line, tickets to sell, et cetera, things like that. So that's a relevant factor. The other thing I would say is, yeah, if we get north of 10 years, 250, and you know that that's what it's going to take no matter what, that's a, you know, that conversation gets a little straightforward. Vlad's also, though, only 25. And I understand that $25 million locking into a first baseman slash DH, even if he's shown he can hit 300, even if he's shown he can be a 30 home run hitter, we'll say 30 home run hitter rather than 48 home run hitter. You know, I don't think that hamstrings you. And I do worry just a little bit with looking at the zero percentile outcome, which is your run like the Los Angeles Angels are. And yeah, Mike Trout, way better player than Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Injury stuff, who knows how you can project it. Like Mike Trout just, he's gone back to California off a rehab assignment now too, because his knee flared up again. You can't predict that stuff, but yeah, I think my one sticking point with your argument there is I don't want to anchor any of my perspective or my strategy to what if we're the Angels, because if you think there's a possibility you're running your team as poorly as the Angels, you should just hang it up at this point.
Yeah, and look, you know, the flip side of that is you trade away Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for a Hall of Prospects, maybe none of them pan out, and you end up being the Marlins.
They could be anything, even Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
Yeah, no, precisely. But I also think it's important to note with respect to projecting an extension, the Padres gave Eric Hosmer $144 million in the not too distant past. Chris Bryant just got $182 million from the Rockies, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., given his age, given his pedigree, given his Statcast profile, is a much more attractive free agent than either of those two players.
And popularity, it should be noted too, right? Like, you don't want to factor that in as the factor, but when your other teams, like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. moves jerseys, moves tickets, is a well-known guy, like home run derby all-star, gregarious personality and stuff like that. Like other, that is a lower end factor, but that's not a nothing when teams weigh, you know, the marketability and the sellability of a big contract like that.
100%. He's an extremely attractive asset. And I guess ultimately my point is that I don't see much downside risk for him in holding out and going to free agency.
Certainly not.
Because he simply needs to convince one team that he's capable of replicating his 2021 season. And he's going to clear $300 million easy, especially after Juan Soto sets the market this coming offseason with the $500 million contract that he's going to get. Now, obviously, again, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is not the caliber of hitter that Juan Soto is. But, you know, he's got a big platform season coming up. And if he even repeats the numbers that he's putting up this year, I think he's going to clear $300 million easily. So really, I think the Blue Jays are in a tough spot because getting him to sign on the dotted line now is going to require them to sign a deal that they are necessarily uncomfortable with. And I just don't know that they're prepared to do that given the medium and long-term outlook of the franchise. And that kind of boxes them into a position where they either have to win a World Series next year or they got to trade him before next season ends.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a small percentage outcome where there's an extension figure that maybe we don't think is realistic that actually is there. There's no such thing as a hometown discount. There's no such thing as guy wants it. Like, Jalen Brunson of the Knicks aside, which, by the way, only helps James Dolan, not other players. That doesn't really exist, even if it's a tiebreaker. It's, you know, maybe a dollar here and there, but it's probably honestly just washed out by the tax incentive perspective of, you know, when you're weighing different markets in baseball. So that's a tough one. Let's reframe the trade discussion here, because that is, I think your perspective is fair. Even if I'm not all the way there with it, everything we've heard is that they would have to be blown away in a trade offer. So let's reset the conversation now around what's a little likelier, which is everyone expiring is available. However, when you're looking at, like, okay, you're Ross Atkins or Mark Shapiro, and July 31st, you got to sit down and make the sales pitch of, we only sold 2024 guys because we can compete again in 2025. What does that plan look like to you?
I mean, I still think that they can be aggressive in looking to perhaps borrow a Ross Atkins phrase, reduce inefficiencies on the roster. I think that it's undeniable that there are redundancies on this roster. There are, monies that haven't been allocated great, which is to say, I think that they can look ahead to the 2025 roster and not necessarily be married to all of those guys. And there's a couple candidates, for example, that really jump out to me, one being Chad Green, who remains under contract for $10.5 million next year, and the other being Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Chris Bassett's name has also surfaced, but I don't think that you can move Chris Bassett if you're trying to contend in 2025. He's such an essential part of a rotation that's already losing Yusei Kikuchi, may or may not have Alek Manoah. Toronto's starting depth is already highly suspect moving forward. They can't afford to give away another starter. But you look at a guy like Chad Green, if there's a team that wants to take on his almost $11 million salary for next year, I think the Blue Jays would be remiss not to do that, because as sterling as his ERA is and as effective as he looked last night, every single under the hood number and indicator is disconcerting. Career worst in strikeout rate, whiff rate, hard hit rate, average exit velocity, you name it. He'll be 34 next season. That money that he's owed can almost certainly be better spent. And then I think it makes a lot of sense as well to sell high on a guy like IKF, who's had a terrific season, but is ultimately a glorified utility player. His skill set and profile is something that the Jays have an abundance of at the MLB level and in the upper levels of the minors. And I think clearing that roster spot for someone with more upside makes a ton of sense moving forward. So I guess ultimately, yeah, obviously you look to move the guys who are on expiring deals, but also looking to optimize your 2025 roster by getting rid of some of the pieces that maybe aren't the best fit makes a lot of sense for Ross Atkins too as the deadline approaches.
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe the way to phrase that is, okay, you look at Chad Green and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. They're good, useful pieces. You would like to have them on your roster in 2025, but they'll make a combined $18 million. If you're a competent front office, you can get Chad Green and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa production for less than $18 million and route some of that elsewhere. And that's kind of the story of what this past offseason was. If you look at the Kiermaier, the Turner deals, I mean, Chad Green deal was a year prior, but the effect of that Chad Green deal is, you know, those $10 million add up. And I mean, we wouldn't want them to be a below CBT team coming into the season because we want a big market team with that has lots of money to spend. But if they cleared a $30 million or so right now, they would get below that CBT threshold and reset the tax level for next year. So those are important things. If you are a scout from a different team listening, though, ignore what Jonah just said. Chad Green's velocity is back up almost to pre-Tommy John levels. Curveball looks incredible. Don't look on it. StatCast is for nerds. Look at Jonah's glasses. You know, this is Chad Green's good. It's just he's not, you know, he's not 182 ERA good. It's just, you know, the quality of stuff just hasn't got back to that level. Realistically, almost no one's going to be a 182 ERA guy over a long enough sample. The other hard part of the Isaiah Kiner-Falefa element is he's one of the best guys to talk to on the team, like pregame and stuff like that. Which again, I think is not a perfect proxy for like, hey, he could fit in any clubhouse. He's a guy teams would like to have, but like, it's a guy who's done it in New York. He's done it, you know, he's been through those pressure cookers and stuff like that. Even if the performance wasn't as strong, I think he would have a market certainly. Okay. With the 2025 competing in mind, when you are working through these trades, are you, if you are Atkins and Shapiro, prioritizing nearer term prospects because of the potential to backfill or help down the line, or like the alternate? There are three perspectives here, really. One is get nearer term guys, maybe they can help next year. Second is get nearer term guys because, you know, you can flip them for something later, but they're not necessarily like a guy who's available in AAA right now. If he could help a major league team, it would probably be on a major league roster. And then the other is like, you just got to swing for upside. You got a bottom 10 farm system. You got to get better prospects in here. Where do you land in terms of what are you targeting in these, you know, deals for the expiring guys or a Chad Green IKF type?
I think you have to go for the highest upside player rather than someone who's closer to the big leagues. Look, these are not superstar players you're trading away. The returns are going to be modest for the likes of Jimmy Garcia and IKF and Chad Green and even Yusei Kikuchi. So further limiting that upside, or at least the pool of potential players, by narrowing your scope to players who are closer to the big leagues feels silly to me. And I mean, you're not going to fill every need on the 2025 roster through deadline trades for marginal players. That's just not how competitive rosters are built. You know, in order for the Blue Jays to get to a place where their roster for 2025 is capable of winning a World Series, they're going to need to be active in free agency, pull off some creative trades. It's not going to be by, you know, filling out the holes with the guys that they acquired for half a season of, you know, a seventh inning reliever or, you know, Danny Jansen or whomever. So I think you need to target upside, you know, not only because, you know, their farm system is in such a poor state, but, you know, I just think that the close to the big leagues guys you're going to get for the players they're trading away are not going to be the guys who get the Blue Jays over the edge and where they need to be for 2025. So, yeah, absolutely. Go for, you know, the highest ceiling players, the best talent available, so to speak.
Yeah, not the Will Warren types. Hey, 25-year-old in AAA who could probably start some games for you right now. No disrespect to Will Warren. He's just the name that comes up the most often in terms of like, hey, guy in AAA. I know he's got like a 6 ERA, but all the pitch design guys like him a lot more than that. Okay. I told you we would mention this, so it's not putting you on the spot, but it's also just a difficult question to answer anyway. Landing spots that make a particular amount of sense to you or you particularly like for some of these Jays? I know we talked a couple of Vlad ones, but for the other pieces.
I mean, I think the truth of the matter is, you know, with the exception of Vlad, who I don't think they're going to trade, to be clear, you know, I don't think it would terribly sting to see a Yusei Kikuchi or a Jimmy Garcia go to even, you know, one of the Blue Jays division or foremost rivals.
Do the trade that's best for your team. I don't care if the Orioles have a better 2024 postseason if that's the trade that makes you that much better in 2025.
Exactly. You know, the Baltimore Orioles have the best farm system in baseball. If they're offering you, you know, the best deal for Yusei Kikuchi or Danny Jansen or whomever it is, you take that deal. You know, the sad reality is the Blue Jays can't afford to be picky about who they're doing business with right now. That's the position that they're in. So, you know, I don't think it terribly matters where their players end up. They just need to make sure that they're maximizing the value that they get back in return. So I kind of avoided answering your question.
But it is a valid point. There are, you'll get the odd Twitter reply or text line text or whatever, about, you know, you can't trade them in division. I understand that a bit more on guys with term, but even then, like we've gone from 19 games a year against a division opponent to 13. And if you win a trade, that has made your division opponent weaker then, right? Like there are win-wins that exist out there, but you're not on the same timeline, especially with the expiring guys. I do not care where they go. Get the best possible return.
Not even a little bit. And to your other point, if the Orioles are going to offer the Blue Jays Jackson Holiday for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.,
sure.
You take that deal. You take that deal 8 days a week right now.
Yeah, sure. If they're why don't we do some other ones here? Shohei Ohtani for Chad Green, Juan Soto for IKF. Let's get into those ones. All right. What about outside of Toronto? What is the non-Jays team you're most curious about or most interested in over these next couple of days?
I mean, truthfully, I think it's Baltimore. Look, they're gunning hard for their first consecutive AL East title in 50 years, man. It hasn't happened since 73-74. And they desperately need an impact starter for their playoff rotation. Whether they win their division or end up a wildcard team, they need another impact starter, especially with Kyle Bradish done for the year. And they're uniquely positioned to add one of those impact starters who has controllability, too, in either Tarek Skubal or Garrett Crochet because they have a uniquely strong farm system. Recently ranked as the best in baseball. You know, they could add one of those two lefties, you know, both of whom are sort of contending for the AL Cy Young Award. They could swing a deal and reunite with Jack Flaherty, who's having a tremendous bounce back season in Detroit. In any event, I think that they're going to be making a splash. It isn't, you know, the splashiest market in terms of available bats, but there's a lot of really, really good starting pitchers available, and Baltimore desperately needs one, not only to consolidate their lead in the AL East, but to realistically vie for that World Series title that they've been waiting for.
All right, we've gone a little long here, but I do have some Jays deadline trivia for you, and I've been preparing a longer Jays deadline trivia because I have 4 hours to fill on the deadline day, and nothing's going to happen until after my show's over. So maybe we'll have you back on Tuesday for a little bit, and we'll do more of this, but are you ready for a couple?
Let's do it, buddy.
Okay, these are some high-level ones. The Toronto Blue Jays won trade deadline, traded away the player who has been traded more times than anyone else in Major League Baseball history. Do you know who that player is?
It's got to be a relief pitcher or a starting pitcher. My instinct says relief pitcher. I'm going to guess that it was
Octavio Dotel. How about someone who's done both?
Mm-hmm. So it's not Octavio Dotel.
It is. There are three very reasonable answers you could give for this one. There is a correct answer, but there are three very reasonable guesses, and Octavio Dotel is one of those very reasonable guesses. He is not the correct answer.
Okay. It's not Octavio Dotel. Could it be Edwin Jackson?
That is the second of the three that is not the correct answer.
Man, oh, man. Oh, man. It's relatively contemporary, right? Like it's
2016 was the deadline.
Yeah.
And they traded him away.
Right. Oh,
do you just
man.
Want it?
Yeah, give it to me.
He has been traded 10 times in his major league career. He didn't play for as many teams as Octavio Dotel and Edwin Jackson. He ended up playing for 9 different teams, but got traded 10 times. Jesse Chavez.
Wow. I wouldn't have gotten that, but man, shout out to Jesse Chavez just having an incredibly lengthy big league career playing for every team under the sun.
Yeah.
And getting traded a million times.
He lasted 17 seasons and pitched in 638 games. This is his. Insane. So he was drafted by the Rangers, traded to the Pirates, traded to the Rays, traded to the Braves, traded to the Royals, traded to the purchased by the Athletics. It must have been very, very inexpensive. Selected off waivers by the Jays at one point, got back to the Athletics, got back to the Jays via trade for Liam Hendricks, if you remember. That's who they gave up for Jesse Chavez. The Jays then traded him to the Dodgers for Mike Bolsinger. He gets free agency, probably thinks, oh my God, I can finally choose my own destination. Signs with the Rangers. Immediately they trade him to the Cubs. Then got traded to the Braves. Then got traded to the Angels. Got plucked off the waivers by the Braves after that as well. Man, what a
life.
10 times he got traded.
That's crazy.
Okay, so the other two answers there, though, are good ones. Dotel was traded 7 times, and Edwin Jackson was traded 7 times. So Edwin Jackson, the time that he actually played with the Blue Jays was in 2019. But the trade with Edwin Jackson and the Toronto Blue Jays, technically two of the trades, came
in Colby Rasmus deal
in 2011. Yes. It is a weirdly, like, it was structured as two different trades instead of a three-team deal. Do you remember the specifics of this trade?
I remember the Blue Jays acquired Corey Patterson in that trade, or gave up Corey Patterson.
Gave up Corey Patterson.
Gave up Corey Patterson, gave up Mark Szczepanski.
Yeah, and Octavio Dotel.
And Octavio Dotel.
And Edwin Jackson. Yeah, who they had just, so they traded Jason Frazier and Zach Stewart for Mark Tahan and Edwin Jackson, and then immediately turned around and traded Edwin Jackson, Octavio Dotel, Corey Patterson, Mark Szczepanski to the Cardinals for Colby, Brian Tallett, Trevor Miller, and PJ Walters.
Wow.
That is three teams and 11 players. And two of the like most traded guys of all time. What a mess of a deadline in 2011.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Yeah. It's a fun one. Octavio Dotel.
I need another question. I need to redeem myself before.
No, that's a tough one, man. Edwin Jackson, yeah, and Octavio Dotel both got traded 7 times and they're not the answer. It's also, I mean, that 2011 team was just a weird one. Like, they went 81-81. I think that was the Brett Laurie call-up year. So we got some, like, fun moments down the stretch. But just a chaos trade deadline. Okay, we'll go to a different year here. Okay, what do we got? Okay, so Zach Stewart was a part of that trade. In 2009, the Blue Jays had acquired him as part of a much more important trade. Do you remember what trade he was a part of?
I believe the Scott Rolen, Edwin Encarnacion deal.
That is correct. Scott Rolen for Edwin Encarnacion, Zach Stewart, and Josh Roenicke.
We're back.
Yeah.
We're back, baby.
That's a good one. That's a good pull. This is not a trade question, but in the era of post-deadline trade waivers.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember who the Jays lost on trade waivers after that deadline? Didn't end up trading him. Just let him go. Revocable waivers. And they were like, you know what? Just take him.
I know that Edwin Encarnacion, I think, was claimed on waivers at one point.
But that was more of a straight waiver, and then they got him back. This was a much bigger deal in 2009. You were a child, but...
Was it Alex Rios?
It was Alex Rios. The Jays had just signed him to that like big, I think, 7 or 8 year contract or something like that. And JP Ricciardi, who will join the show at 11 o'clock, was just like, we'll put him on waivers and let's see. And then there wasn't a trade taker, but the White Sox just ate the money.
You'll have to follow up with JP about that.
I intend to ask about that one. You want to do another one from the JP Ricciardi era?
Absolutely.
I know it's not your sweet spot. I know Anthopoulos era is your sweet spot.
I don't know,
spot.
Man. I'm cooking now. This is the heat check right
okay.
here. Okay.
In 2005, the Blue Jays traded John McDonald to the Detroit Tigers for in what was called a conditional deal. You remember what they eventually got back?
No.
It's
no,
so silly.
Give me a hint. Give me a hint.
I already said his name in setting up the question.
In setting up the question?
It's a tough hit.
John McDonald.
They got John McDonald back in the offseason. It was not technically John McDonald for John McDonald because it wasn't like for a player to be named later and then it became John McDonald, but it was like this weird conditional trade. I'm going to ask JP about that as well. They trade John McDonald away and then they get him back in trade after the season to like complete the deal.
It wasn't a trade. It was a loan.
Okay. What else do we want to do here? Okay, here's one. 2006, this was the Jays were pretty good this year. That was the year they won 87 games. Coming off of, so 2004, they win 67. It's that really, really bad year where everyone's hurt. And then 2005, the John McDonald year, they got back to 500. And then 2006 was probably the best year of that era. They won 87 games. They made three deals at the deadline and post-deadline waivers. None of them were all that consequential. They traded Scott Schoenweiss for a player to be named later that never made the majors. They sold Eric Hinsky to the Red Sox so he could start his little run of I'm gold, everyone I go to wins.
Wins the World Series, yeah.
Yeah, and then they traded Vinny Chulk and Shea Hillenbrand. For whom?
Jeremy Accardo.
Yeah, there you go. 5 years Jeremy Accardo lasted in that Blue Jays bullpen.
Didn't he have a 37 save season?
I know he's like, he's very like with Jeremy when Jordan Romano, not Jeremy Romano, was coming up the saves list. I was pretty astonished to remember that. Yeah, he had a 30 save season and 35 overall. He had a 2.14 ERA that year.
Man, oh man.
And then turned into a pumpkin the next season, as relievers do.
Relievers do, man.
That's a tough one.
I can't believe that was a huge pull. That was a huge
pull. That was a good one. Yeah. Yeah. That was a good one. And anytime you bring up Scott Schoenweiss and guys like that, like this is, I made a joke on Twitter last night because the Dan and Joe were talking about Kevin Cash and they were showing all the old Kevin Cash as a Jays prospect pictures. And I was like, this is MVP baseball 05 coded for me. Like his player picture was still the Blue Jays. And now we're going like Scott Schoenweiss, Shea Hillenbrand. I'm like, okay, this is Vinny Chalk, Frank Menachino, you name it. Although Frank Menachino couldn't use his real name in that game because
No licensing rights.
Yeah, exactly. Because
much like Barry Bonds and Kevin Millar.
Yes. Barry Bonds was Jim Dowd.
John Dowd.
John. Okay, last one before I let you go. I got JP Ricciardi coming on at 11 o'clock. Anything you want me to ask him?
Oh, man. Definitely clarifying the Rios move is a good one. And also has his opinion on Adam Dunn changed at all?
Well, he has done the public mea culpa on the Adam Dunn thing before.
So I know, that was a low blow.
Yeah, I'm not going to bring that one up. That's as low a blow as Cal Quantrill yesterday, which if we got the censor button ready upstairs, we can go into that if anyone missed it. Jonah, thanks so much for taking the time out, buddy. I took more of your time than I anticipated, but if you are around on deadline day and not doing stuff, we can do some more of this. I'm going to have a big trade deadline trivia doc ready to go because those 4 hours aren't going to kill themselves.
Yeah, buddy. Sounds like a plan. Thanks for having me, man.
All right, man. Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score. Make sure you're checking him out at Bierenball on Twitter and then all his great work over at The Score from a written and YouTube perspective. We'll do a bunch more deadline trivia stuff where we have dead spots or with fun guests who like to do that stuff over the next couple of days. I focused on the JP Ricciardi era because he's joining us at 11 o'clock. Chris Black will join us at 11:30. As well to kind of, go through some of this stuff, talk Kevin Kiermaier, who yesterday told the Tampa Times that he will be retiring at the end of this season. So this is his last go. Always fun to contextualize Kevin Kiermaier as a historical defender where Chris Bach will have to refresh us on the numbers. I think Andrew Jones is the only guy that like on a statistical basis has a claim to be a more valuable outfielder defensively over the years than Kevin Kiermaier. We'll talk about that as well. But JP Ricciardi coming up at 11. We're going to take a break here. We'll take a couple of your texts when we come back. 590, 590, standard message and data rates may apply. We'll open up the mailbag in this next segment as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy. Jays win last night 6-2. They'll wrap this series up at 3:07 down at Rogers Center. It's a work-from-dome day, so leave work early. And don't even work from the dome. Just don't work for the afternoon. What is your boss going to do about it? We're going to talk to JP Ricciardi and Chris Black in the second hour. We got a few minutes here. So we'll take a look in that text line, in that mailbag. You can always text us 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. Rick in Grimsby is very fired up about the Mike Trout to comparison to Vladdy. He hasn't done anything for team success, just individual accolades. Rick, man, this is how baseball works. Like, what should Mike Trout have done differently to help his team success? Like honestly, text in right now and let us know. What could Mike Trout do differently other than hitting 40 home runs, stealing 40 bases, hitting over 300, playing premium defense in the outfield? Like, this guy was individually worth 8 or 9 or 10 runs every, or 8 or 9 or 10 wins every single year for like a decade. He is not the GM. He didn't build the team around him. Like, that is the extent of what a hitter can do to help his team. I know it's a team sport, but it is a team sport where, like, again, I don't know what you want him to do. You want him to lay down a bunt so Howie Kendrick can get from first to second so that, I don't know, Mark Trumbo can pop out and not score him. I don't know what you want Mike Trout to do differently there. It's also worth saying that it's not as if this era of the Toronto Blue Jays and their individual players has led to a ton of team success either. A couple playoff appearances, certainly better than the Angels. You'd prefer to have been the Blue Jays the last couple years to the Angels, even with Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani. But the blame for that does not fall on Mike Trout. Goodness. Okay, a couple of older ones from earlier in the week. Jake and Port Perry asked about acquiring Cedric Mullins since the Orioles are looking to move him. Maybe a Kikuchi for Mullins type deal, given that Mullins could contribute next year or something like that. That straight up is a little underwhelming. I mean, Mullins is a guy who, yeah, you could slot in. He'll probably make maybe $10 million next year. He made $6.3 this year. So, yeah, somewhere around $10 million as an ARB guy and then as a free agent in 2026. I mean, it's reasonable. I do think they'll explore guys like that, guys who can maybe help for next year. Cedric Mullins has been really bad this year, though. So if you're looking at another left-handed hitting, kind of not quite full-time bench bat outfielder type who's going to make $10 million, we just kind of talked about it. That's the type of move where you'd rather try to find that production a little less expensively if you can. I do think they'll explore that type of deal, getting guys back with a little bit of term who can contribute next year. I don't know necessarily that Mullins is exactly that. Maybe they see more in the underlings, but he's kind of been on a steady-ish, like, four-year decline now as an offensive piece, even though he's not even 30 yet. So I'd have to dig in on that specific decline a little bit more, but that would probably be the red flag there. Hank in Vancouver asked, what an ideal Vlad extension would look like. How many years would Vlad side want? I mean, Vlad this close to free agency would want as many years as possible. I don't know that they would care that much about re-entering them. Maybe you give a player opt out after 6 years or something like that, and you explore that. But I think you'd probably be talking about a 10-year deal. Don't know if you'd go as far as 12, given he won't hit free agency until 27, and the way that his player type ages, and unless you're David Ortiz, you maybe don't go deep into your 30s there. And then in terms of money, Jonah and I just kind of talked about it. Vlad will probably want $30 million a year plus on a 10-year plus deal, and the Jays will want to be less than that. I don't know, like, it would be hard to see them going over 10 years 250 right now, but if he turns in another season next year where he hits 300 and has 40 bombs, maybe that changes. A lot of ifs, and this is one of the interesting things about letting a potential extension get down to the wire as they are here, is that the Jays are gonna probably, if you didn't care that much about the relationship, the way you would negotiate this is the Blue Jays would look at, well, look at what you did last year, and it was only worth about one win, and your player type hasn't aged well particularly. And Vlad's camp will be like, well, look at 2021 and look at what he's done over the last 3 months this year. If he hits the market coming off a season like that, he's going to get $300 million. He's going to get maybe $350 million. And that's where you run into the stalemate. Maybe there's a place in between, but there's a reason that this extension hasn't got done yet, despite both sides saying they'd be open to it and wanting to be, wanting to extend that relationship ostensibly. Someone who didn't sign there has asked if, would you bring James Paxton in for the Canadian vibes? He was DFA'd by the Dodgers. I would bring James Paxton in because post-deadline, you're just going to need guys to start. If he clears waivers and is free, I mean, he only had a ERA of 4.43. It's not like he's been terrible. So yes to James Paxton as a depth starting pitching ad. Let's take a break. Let's talk to JP Ricciardi on the other side as JStock Plus continues.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. We are just a couple days out from the trade deadline. The Blue Jays figure to be busy. Someone who's navigated a whole bunch of those trade deadlines is former Jays general manager, former Major League exec for the Mets, the A's, the Giants, and host of The Brushback on YouTube, joined now by JP Ricciardi. JP, thank you for doing this. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing pretty well, man. Curious, before we talk deadline stuff, how are you enjoying doing the Brushback? You in the host role instead of coming on with guys like me for a change?
It's fun because we're talking baseball and we're talking things that I think are really interesting about behind the scenes, you know, parts of the game that most people don't hear about. We've had great guests. I mean, we're having Peter Gammons on next week. We had Tim Kirkchen. We had Buster Olney, Mike Bordick, Frank Catalanato, Frank Menachino, Jason Isner. We had some great guests, so it's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear. I caught a bit of a few of those. I actually had just mentioned Frank Menachino in our last segment. So fun that you've had him on. In terms of fun, you've been a general manager. You've worked in front offices. This time right now, trade deadline time, is this the most fun time or is the stress level too high for it to like really be enjoyable moment to moment?
I don't think the stress level's that high. I mean, listen, we're not storming the beaches in Normandy here. We're it's baseball. It's just an opportunity for you to either try to improve your club that's in contending right now, or try to subtract from a club that's not going anywhere and try to start setting your sights for next year and a couple of years down the road. So it's just really opportunistic for you.
So what is this, you know, this week like? Obviously, everything kind of – nothing ever really happens until the deadline, but I'd imagine there are a lot of conversations going on that don't end up going anywhere, really. You handled a bunch of these deadlines. What is this, you know, week leading up to the deadline like for a front office?
Yeah, it's a lot of tire kicking. It's a lot of throwing ideas out. It's a lot of listening to ideas. It's a lot of you and your group forming ideas to present to other people. You have these great ideas, not so much delusions of grandeur, but great ideas that you think will help you. But you presented to four or five teams and no one has any interest. So, you know, you're back to the drawing board again. I think what you have to always keep in mind is how do I make my club better? How do I make an opportunity for this club to, whether to compete or, like I said earlier, you know, build it for the next few years down the road. So, I mean, you just got to really be on the phone as much as you can. I know today they use a lot of emails and they use a lot of texts. Whatever it is, whatever way you communicate, whatever that form is, you know, you've got to make sure you're exhausting every possible resource to try to do something that helps your club.
So you're having all of these conversations. You know, that's part of why it drags out to the deadline. You want to talk to 29 different teams or whatever. How much do the relationships you have with the different front office, different executives around the league, like help once you get to the finish line? Like I know you, for example, when you were with Toronto, made a bunch of deals with Oakland and you had been a part of that group prior. How much does that help get things over the finish line?
A ton. It goes a long way. I mean, if you have relationships with people that you've had, you've worked with in the past, I mean, you cut right through all the minutia and you get right to the point. And that's why we made a lot of trades with Oakland. And, you know, a lot of them worked out great for us. We got Eric Hinsky, who ended up being the Rookie of the Year. We got Corey Lytle, who ended up pitching great for us. Ted Lilly became an All-Star. Bobby Kilty, we turned into Ted Lilly. So that familiarity led to us being able to get deals. And then we did smaller deals, too, that really helped us out, that kind of got us over the hump. But it's just a matter of having relationships with people. That does go a long way. And, you know, we made deals with the Yankees. We made deals with Tampa Bay in our division. We made deals with the Red Sox, you know, some big, some little. But, you know, the relationships definitely help.
Yeah, it's a big one. So with respect to that, maybe you don't have to name names here if you don't want to, but I am curious as to your experience, whether with the Jays or in any of the other front offices you've been a part of. Do you have any like stories of annoying experiences with other front offices, a trade you thought you had done and fell apart, a team that kind of led you on or anything? Like what are kind of the other front office taboos at deadline time?
Yeah, listen, some front offices are easy to deal with and some front offices are hard to deal with. And I think it's getting harder now. I think trades are harder to make now because teams really value their younger players and maybe value them more than they do the major league talent that's actually producing at the major league level. So if you're aggressive and you want to get stuff done and you run into a group that's very slow moving and is very methodical, you know, you're probably going to get frustrated with that group. And what I found was, after the initial call, you pretty much knew if you had something you could do with them or not. And then I just didn't waste my time with them. And that was, you know, whether I said, I mean, you know, it was 8 years in Toronto, then another 8 in New York, and obviously a lot of years in Oakland being heavily involved with every kind of trade imaginable. So you learn who is willing and who isn't willing. And, you know, there's teams out there that just want information. They want you to tell them who you think are good players and kind of let them take stock of their own organization and say, well, so many teams think this about this guy, we better not trade him. But my philosophy was always, and I used to share this with Billy Beane all the time, I really don't care who I'm giving up if I like what I'm getting back. So if what's coming back to me is going to help me be better, I don't want to give up something that's good, but sometimes you have to do it. You know, we were able to trade one time. It wasn't a trading deadline, but we were able to trade Dave Bush for Lyle Overbay, and we had the deal done, and Milwaukee called us back and said, listen, we think we need a little bit more. And I said, well, what do you think you need? And they asked for Gabe Gross, and I said, okay, give me 10 minutes. I said to the guys in the room, you guys want to trade Gabe Gross to finish off this deal? And most guys said yes. There was one or two that said no, and I said, well, we're not going to let Gabe Gross get in the way of us getting a guy with 50 doubles and a really good player. So we made the trade. So, I mean, it's just there's common sense involved with some of these trades. That's how we got Jeremy Accardo. We had to throw in an extra player to get him, but he ended up being a good player for us, and we got rid of a player that we had designated for assignment in Shea Hillenbrand. So you got to be creative, you got to be open, and you got to be willing to take chances.
Okay, that's super helpful. We were talking about the Vinny Chulk, Shea Hillenbrand for Jeremy Accardo one earlier in the show as well, and now we know Vinny Chulk was the extra guy there. So in terms of managing in different situations, obviously over your years with the Blue Jays, there were a couple different, you know, there were down years, there were good years. 2003 was a fascinating one from outside because you guys were pretty good heading into the deadline. Now, obviously, that's the era before the third wild card where, you know, being an 86, 87 win team then isn't quite as helpful as it is now. But you guys were looking at a scenario where Shannon Stewart was about to be a free agent. You guys were pretty competitive, though. How does a front office, or how did you guys navigate? And obviously, again, this is one, you guys got Bobby Keelty back, who you were then able to turn into Ted Lilly. But navigating that, hey, we're pretty good. There's a chance that we can make a push to the playoffs here, but we've got to be realistic about this guy who's probably not going to re-sign with us. How do you navigate that aspect? This isn't really relevant to the 2023 Jays or 2024 Jays because they're not competitive right now. But how did you guys handle that in 2003?
Well, we had a good club. We won 86 games. Like you said, if we were in today's game, we would have been a playoff team. And I still think that year we should have won 90 games because we blew a lot of games late in the season. But regardless, we tried to add. I always was under the impression that if your team worked their butt off and got themselves in any kind of contention, you know, it's up to you to try to add and bring some players in. And that's what we was. You know, maybe I'm just on the outside looking in, but I still believe you should play the game to win. I don't believe it should be talking about how many prospects you got, what your process is, what your stadium looks like, what your locker room looks like. I think you should play to win. And, you know, you have to understand, too, back then I had a $50 million payroll with very little leeway to go above it or go beyond it with one guy making 33% of that payroll. So I didn't have a lot of leeway. And I had to do a lot of creative things. And one of them was when we traded Shannon Stewart, the Twins couldn't take any money. So I had to eat his contract to get Bobby Keelty, but I also knew I could get Ted Lilly for Bobby Keelty. So sometimes you bite the bullet. And our philosophy was always try to win.
Which is, that's a good philosophy. It's certainly one that fans appreciate, that push to win all the time. Wanted to ask you a couple other ones about during your tenure there. And I mean, obviously the biggest trade you made in retrospect was the one for Jose Bautista, for a player to be named later that became Robinson Diaz. There was the Edwin Encarnacion as part of the Scott Rolen trade as well. Did you, when the Jays had the success that they had in 2015 and 2016, and it was so big here, did you feel a connection to those teams because you had helped bring those guys to Toronto?
I don't think, I look back and obviously Bautista and Encarnacion were good trades, and I'm glad that they came to the Blue Jays and helped. But you have to remember, in 2015, I was with the Mets, and we went to the World Series. And so 2015 was a really special year for us in New York, and I was paying attention to the Blue Jays. I was actually hoping that we played the Blue Jays in the World Series, as I thought that would have been really cool. It didn't come to fruition, but I think you always look back and say, that player helped. But listen, it's a combined effort. There's a lot of people that are involved with making things go right. Success has many fathers and failure has few, as you know. But you always look back and say, hey, that was a pretty good trade. We could have done this a little better. We could have done that a little better. But 2015 for me was really more focused on the Mets. And, it was fun going to the World Series. And, so that year was more focused on the New York Mets.
Yeah, which makes sense. That would have been a fun World Series battle. I certainly would have enjoyed it. I still don't think that Royals team. I don't know. I was once the Royals put up the Blue Jays.
We blew the first game. We had the lead, and Familia tried the quick pitch. The left-handed hitter, I forgot his name now, and he hit a home run, and that kind of turned the whole tide because we could have won Game One with a chance to go back. We obviously lost the first two games, but we could have won Game One. That makes it different when you can split one on the road. But anyway, what are you going to do? We got to the World Series. It was a lot of fun, and it was good to be a part of it.
Yeah, it was fun, and glad you guys had that success there. I had mentioned the Jose Bautista trade. That was a player to be named later. We know that became Robinson Diaz. A lot of trades are for players to be named later, especially back in the era where you could do the post-deadline waiver trades. Can you walk us through a little bit about what a player to be named later trade is? Like, when you make that trade, do you get a list of guys and it's conditional? Is it something that you're going to just kind of trust you can negotiate later? How does that part of it work?
You could do it a lot of ways. You could say this is a list of guys. You could say we'll just scout your system and come up with a guy. But most of the time, the player to be named later is not a very good player.
Right.
Sometimes it just basically turns into cash. You take what basically would be the equivalent of a waiver claim. You'll take the $25,000 or $50,000 because you really don't need the player. If he's not a really good player, you're going to eventually have to release that player anyway. So let that team do it and you take the money. But the player to be named later very seldom is a high-profile guy.
Yeah, not very often at all. At least in my research, it doesn't. Not a lot of guys who either made the majors or made it back to the majors and things like that. Do you remember how the 2005 one with John McDonald worked? Like it has always given the impression that you guys traded John McDonald for a player to be named later, who then ended up being John McDonald. I know that's not like exactly true, but do you remember how that one shook out when you guys dealt him and then got him right back?
Yeah, well, basically, the Tigers called. They needed an extra infielder, and, we didn't have a lot of playing time for Johnny at the time. So, we said, we'll trade you John McDonald for a player to be named later, which ended up being John McDonald. I always tell him, John McDonald got traded for John McDonald. But the worst part of the trade was coming into my house, and my wife and my two kids were so mad at me for trading John McDonald because they loved Johnny. And so I was the scorn to be named later. So anyway, we ended up the next year we needed a backup infielder and we traded for Johnny back and he played great for us.
There you go. John McDonald for John McDonald. What a fun wrinkle there. JP, I know you keep an eye on the league and you're well tapped in. What do you make of the situation the Blue Jays are in here? Obviously, this is a competitive window that extends beyond 2024. They've got another year before Bo and Vlad hit free agency. But things really haven't gone well this year. And they haven't, over the last couple of years, been able to get out of that first gear that we kind of expected them to. What have you made of the Blue Jays' struggles from afar?
Well, I think it's a talented club that just underachieved. And I don't know what I'm not there every day. I'm not with the club every day. I just kind of watch from the outside. But to me, it's too talented a club to be playing the way they're playing. They're obviously not scoring. They're not scoring runs. Their offense is a little lacking. Obviously, Bichette being hurt doesn't help. He's such a good player. So they got some serious questions that they're going to have to answer going forward. And, you know, Bichette and Guerrero are not going to be cheap to keep them. So you're going to have to make that distinction that if we are going to keep them, that we're going to build around them and put a lot of money into them. And that's a tough decision that they're going to have to make. So I think with the trading deadline, they have some options. I don't see them trading Bichette and Guerrero, but I can see them trading some of the other pieces that, you know, may bring them back some things that can help them go forward.
So when you hear, you know, when you hear, you know, Ross Atkins talk about, he does media availability and talks about the accountability level and the accountabilities with him for the team underperforming and things like that. What does that mean for you? What does that mean to a front office? Like, what does accountability look like for a group? How do you guys regroup if things don't go as well as they were supposed to after a season?
Well, it all comes down to ownership. If ownership continues to want to have a very high payroll, then you've got a lot of ways you can go. You can move money that's invested right now in players and try to reinvest in other players through the trade and change the makeup of the club. You can hold on to these players and try to take another stab at it. But if ownership comes to you and says, listen, we want to trim down payroll, then you got to get rid of players. So a lot of it is dictated by ownership. And then a lot of it is dictated by, look, the bottom line is, you can say what you want, the Blue Jays are underachieving. So they have to be, it sounds like they're being held accountable, or they're holding themselves accountable for that. And because of it, you know, they'll obviously have to make some moves. But, you know, fans don't want to hear about prospects. Fans don't want to hear about hope. Fans want to see wins. And we're all held accountable by how well we play. And whether you got a $50 million payroll or $250 million payroll, you know, you yourself want to win, but the fans want to win too. And you owe it to those fans to be able to do the best you can to try to put a winning team on the field.
So do you remember operating the 2009 trade deadline? I know that was the Scott Rolen trade year, and what was it like to navigate that while your job security maybe wasn't necessarily 1,000% secure? Was that on your mind, or do you have to compartmentalize that?
No, you do what's right for the team. The bottom line is, ownership came to us and said they had promised that payroll was going to go up to a certain amount. And then in midstream, they pulled back and said, well, we don't want the payroll to go to that now. So that was our mandate. And with that mandate, we knew that we weren't going to continue to try to put a winning team on the field. We were going to have to be a team that went back to being a $50 or $60, $70 million payroll. So we had to get rid of players. And the number one thing was we had a great relationship with Halliday. And we told Roy, we're going to try to win here. And that's why he re-signed with us. And then once they pulled the rug out from under us and said that we have to, you know, trim down the payroll, well, Roy didn't want to be a part of that, and obviously we didn't want him to be a part of that. So what we did was, you know, we went to Roy and said, look, Roy, we're not going to win here. We're going to have to rebuild this thing all over again, and I know you don't want to be a part of it, so we're going to try to trade you and get you in a position that you can win, and we're going to use you as cooperation. Where do you want to go? And so we started the process of that, so then we traded Roland, and, you know, we had to start moving some money around to get ourselves in a fiscal spot heading into the next year.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think it's something that, you know, hopefully this front office is not running into here, but is particularly in that era of the Blue Jays something that's a helpful reminder. Is that kind of, you know, I think back to the Alex Rios waiver situation that year as well, where you guys had just signed him to a long-term deal and then let him go to the White Sox. Was that similarly just like, hey, we signed this deal and we thought we were going one way and then the budget and the goals changed?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, as simple as that. That's exactly what it was. And it was basically, you know, we were in a money, cost-effective, save money way. And what better way to do it than walk out from under $62 million commitment?
Yeah, not bad, right? Okay. JP, what's coming up on the Brushback? Who you got coming for us?
Well, we just finished JP Morosi.
Nice.
He was very, very good. And, you know, obviously he just got back from the Hall of Fame induction ceremony, so he painted a picture of Cooperstown. And if any of your listeners have never been to Cooperstown, they should make it a trip one time, because it's a great situation and it's a great fan experience. And we are having Hall of Famer Peter Gammons next week. And we have, I think, the week after, Joe Castiglione, who was just inducted as the Ford Frick winner at the Hall of Fame. So we've got a bunch of Hall of Famers lined up, and then hopefully we'll start getting some more ex-players as we get into the dog days of August into September. But we've had some great guests, and it's been a lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, can't wait to check those out, JP, at The Brushback on YouTube. Thanks so much for taking the time out this morning.
All right, guys. Take care.
JP Ricciardi, former Jays GM, exec with the Mets, the A's, the Giants, and that show is The Brushback on YouTube. Some fun stuff there, some helpful insight. This is, I mean, it does make me thankful we're past the days of your deadline moves being dictated by budgets. Now, there is obviously a budget component to what the Jays are going to do over the next couple of days here, but that's more of the, can you duck below the competitive balance tax so that, you know, you reset things like, hey, you don't have to pay as high a compensation pick if you sign a free agent. You get a cut better compensation pick back if one of your free agents walks. You know, you're not paying as high a tax level next year, so your budget goes further. That is relevant money stuff, but not the, hey, you got to let a really good player who you just signed to an extension go for financial reasons. We're going to take a break. When we come back, let's talk about Kevin Kiermaier. Kevin Kiermaier told the Tampa Times, Mark Topkin yesterday, that this is it for him. When this year's done, he's out of here. It feels like it's time. He got his 10 years of service time for full pension and things like that. Obviously, the performance offensively has dipped a little bit, not really defensively or on the base paths there. Kevin Kiermaier, without question, one of the very best defensive players we've seen in this generation, and arguably, if you trust the metrics ability to go back in time and things like that, one of the greatest defensive players in the outfield that we've ever seen in terms of defensive value. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Chris Black about Kevin Kiermaier. Yeah, we'll pivot to the heir apparent in Dalton Varsho, who has a case right now. I'll talk about this on Blue Jay Central this afternoon, by the way. He is now, by some defensive metrics, the best left fielder in the American League and the best center fielder in the American League at the same time. So get those double gold gloves ready. We'll talk about Vlad's heater. We'll talk a little bit more trade stuff as well. Chris Black joins us on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ben Ennis.
And I'm Brent Gunning.
We got you covered on all things Leafs, Raptors, and Blue Jays every weekday morning, 6 to 9.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Chris Black will join us in a couple minutes here. Before we get to Chris, there were a couple texts in the text line earlier. We'll do some more of that tomorrow. We'll probably do a bunch of that on deadline day, some Jays deadline trivia and things like that that day as well. Matt in Kitchener. Oh, he had a question for JP that I missed. Sorry about that, Matt in Kitchener. By the way, speaking of Kitchener, very cool to see the Stanley Cup in the 519 yesterday in Oshkosh. Brandon Montour, who won the Stanley Cup, brought it back to First Nations of the Grand River in Oshkosh, which is right down the road from where I grew up. They used to beat the brakes off us in lacrosse all the time. So that was really cool to see. Shout out to Brandon Montour. So Matt, sorry, but I cannot ask JP your question about how at Anaheim with a roster of Trout and Ohtani only made the playoffs once in 20 years. And not at all with Ohtani, by the way. Pretty crazy. Someone who didn't sign theirs asked if Riley Tirada was the next call-up for the Jays. Also pointed out that the only hitting prospects the front office has produced has been late-round picks, if you consider Schneider and Horwitz MLB-level bats. Yeah, we talked about this a lot around draft time, is that the Jays have had success with these kind of higher floor, lower ceiling, good bat to ball, good plate discipline, good approach kind of guys that maybe lack the full power or have a limiting factor defensively or things like that. If you look at the guys who are interesting in the minors, you know, Alan Roden kind of fits that description. Josh Kosevich really fits that description at AA. So yeah, they have an ability to hit on those later round guys, it seems. But obviously it's the ceiling guys that really move the needle for you. Riley Tirada, by the way, who got the bump from AA to AAA about 40 games ago. He's hit well. He has 10 bombs. He has 8 doubles. He's at, 270. The strikeout rate's probably a little high. Strikes at about 27% of the time, so that's probably something they'll keep an eye on. But hey, he has continued to hit. He's one of those guys that maybe wasn't super highly touted. He was a 12th-round pick back in 2021, but every level he's gone to, he hits. And sometimes you just got to believe it when a guy tells you at every level that he can hit. He struggled his first year a little bit, but last year he was absolutely dominant at high A. So he earned the call up to double A, where he's about a league average hitter. This year starts out at double A. And yeah, just like made the case to get up. He has, what's he got? A 945 OPS, even with the high strikeout rate. So it's pretty good. And he's another guy too that can move around the diamond a little bit. He's played first, second, third, left, and right. So it's a good question from whoever didn't sign that question. Frank in Timmins asked, if I had to guess, where will Kikuchi end up? I don't know. It's a tough one. I'm going to say the Dodgers, and it's not for the Japanese player connection. It's just that the Dodgers need pitching, and they are the team that has the most prospects and the most money and things like that. So I'm going to pick them to get every free agent. Yeah, I don't know. Baltimore would be fun. One of the AL Central teams. Milwaukee's probably a little bit more focused on the hitter side right now after the Christian Yelich news. Yeah, they're maybe a little bit more focused on the hitter side. We'll see. So today the Jays have a baseball game to play. That predates the deadline stuff. It's Taj Bradley against Chris Bassett, which should be really, really fun. Chris Bassett had obviously been on this tremendous stretch. He struggled a little bit over his last three, 12 earned over 16 and two thirds innings, nine walks to just 15 strikeouts. But it's Chris Bassett. He's had three game stretches like that before and then went right back to being Chris Bassett. The Rays are also not a team that hits right-handed pitching particularly well. They rank 28th in home runs against righties, and they rank 28th in left-handed hitting home runs against righties. So that's kind of been the thing that's plagued Chris Bassett at times. If he's having trouble, it's that lefty hitting home run, and the Rays are third to last when it comes to that particular skill. Maybe we'll talk about that with Chris Black, but we've got more pressing questions first. He joins us now. He's a producer at Sportsnet. He is Down to Black on Twitter. Chris, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing well, Blake. How are you?
I am. Ooh, look at this setup. We're not in the production truck with screens everywhere today. We got what looks like a relatively fresh haircut and beard trim. Looking good, man.
I appreciate the compliments. It is nothing about me is fresh when it's a day game after a night game. but I appreciate the compliments. I will never say no to a compliment, even if it's at the start of an interview.
Yeah, obviously buttering you up. And it's the compliment is a little bit of a rope-a-dope because I'm going to pivot this to once again asking you about one of our Blue Jays broadcast colleagues going to town on you on the links. What was it? How annoying is it to golf with Joe Siddle, who is like, we hear him on the broadcast the other day talking with Shulman. He's like, yeah, I played baseball. I was also a really good football player. Probably could have played college. really good high school basketball player, too. And then he goes out there. He doesn't golf super often, and he's a really good golfer, too. How annoying are those guys in general?
They're all very, very annoying. just to keep tabs. Now let's keep tabs. Buck Martinez waxed me early in the year. Caleb Joseph waxed me last week at Angus Glen. He shot 73. And Joe Siddle waxed me at Wooden Sticks just a couple days ago.
73 for Caleb.
Yeah, he's a player. Joe, we had a blast. Wooden Sticks always takes really good care of us. It's a great course. He hadn't played it before. He put his first tee shot on the green on the 17th, the replica Sawgrass Island. I did not. both of those shots were videotaped. The footage will not make it to social media at any point.
Not even of Joe's? That's a little selfish.
We'll find Joe's.
Joe. This is, and sorry to the audience who doesn't care about this, but who is, like, is Caleb the best golfer of the, like, sports media people and baseball players that you've golfed with?
He's up there. Justin Morneau's really good. He's gotten the bug big time. But if we're going to, like, put it on, like, an age, like, on a
Buck
game per age, it's Buck.
Okay. Like,
Buck played at a really tough course, and, like, he's an outstanding golfer. Like, he's just – but it's the same kind of deal with Siddle, which gets frustrating because they just put in the fairway every single hole.
Yeah.
And it's not my game.
Nope. It would not be my game either. All power, all power, no finesse in all things. Sure. My trouble with golf, too, is, like, I'm such a high-effort guy in every sport that you can't – that's going to make you worse at golf. You can't just try harder and like run baseball around fast and be physical.
Yeah, you can't effort your way to a better score. You can grind away on the range, but yeah, out on the course, you can't effort your way.
Yeah, I need golf to add a defensive component for me to be good at it somehow. Speaking of defense.
Speaking of.
Yeah, Kevin Kiermaier telling Mark Tompkins of the Tampa Bay Times yesterday that he's hanging him up at the end of this year. Makes sense. Well into his 30s here. You know, the bat, you know, maybe hot and cold. He has dealt with a lot of injury stuff over his career. But the defense is still really good. The base running's good. Man, how do we contextualize this? Like I know we are late 30s to early 40s here between us. So our generation probably goes back and catches enough Andrew Jones for Andrew Jones to be an argument. But Kevin Kiermaier, really, if we cut it off at, say, the, 2005 and forward, probably a really good case as the best defensive outfielder we've seen, right?
Yeah, in like the measurable era. So another way of saying the defensive run saved era, he's the best outfielder of this generation. So, and that's going back 20 years. Right. And not only is he the best outfielder, regardless of position, where he really shows his value is center field. Like there, he's 40 clear in defensive run saved of any other center fielder. And that speaks to, like, to me, what I think that speaks to more than anything is, and Mark Simon, who kind of helms the defensive run save stuff, mentioned this to me, and it's a point well taken, is it's hard to play elite center field for a long time. So that's why you see so many guys who eventually move out of that position, because it is so physically demanding and it's tough to play at a really elite level. But Kiermaier's done that. He's 40 clear of the next closest. Like, I want to say, like, he's like 150 and the next closest guy is 110 or something in center field. And then the next closest guy below that is like 80. So it's really hard to be elite, elite, elite at that one position. And Mike Petriello posted an article. He wrote a story last year trying to like frame Kiermaier's defense. And, you know, while it's true that there aren't really reliable numbers before defensive runs saved, like Baseball Reference like tries to do it just using basic, like, you know, how many putouts is a guy getting in a given season or a given year, whatever. But, you know, that list is very satisfying when you look at it, because it's names like Andrew Jones, it's names like Devon White. Right. Like, and so when you see names like that, along with Kiermaier, like I think Kiermaier's number two behind Andrew Jones, like in my mind, in my eyes, Jones and Devon White are the two best that I've ever seen. You know, there are guys who've lived a little longer than us who would have Willie Mays in that conversation. And Willie Mays is right on that list as well. So while there aren't perfect numbers, what Petriello's story kind of puts into good context is like, the numbers that we have do a pretty good job of kind of confirming or supporting what everyone sees with their eyes as well.
And here's how I would describe Kevin Kiermaier's defensive value outside of the numbers. He played an annoying level of defense against the Blue Jays for like a decade in the division. Right. And then within like three games last year was like, okay, the Tampa stuff's off. He's a fan favorite. Let's go. Like, let's, like,
yeah, like that home opener. Yeah. So was it two innings in? Was it two innings in or
something like that?
Or?
And like the new dimensions look like, oh, that was going to be Kiermaier Alley with the, you know, jumpable fence in center field and stuff like that. It was like, if you can go from a division rival and then like game one, everyone's behind you and you've shaken it off, that says a lot about how fun it is to watch you. And I guess that's the other thing too, is like, defensive value is obviously super important, but elite defense like this in the outfield is just also a blast to watch.
Yeah, it's my favorite player to watch. Like, we all know I was big on the Varsho trade because for that reason. Like, I love watching these guys play. Kevin Pillar, I loved watching play. You know, we've been blessed as Blue Jays fans to have some really awesome defensive outfielders.
Vernon Wells.
Vernon Wells as well. Like, he had a great, for those who don't live in the horrible world of social media, somebody tried to rip him on social media, and Vernon's response of just like, sorry, it came so easy to me. I guess these gold gloves must be lying.
Yeah.
And that's what I always love.
The criticism, to be clear, was like, someone said Vernon never looked like he was trying that hard out there. And Vernon's response was like, sorry, I read the ball so well and got elite jumps.
Exactly. And what I always loved when Vernon did a few things with us on Blue Jay Central over the years. And what I really loved, like the first time we saw him do something with us, like if this, my backdrop is the dome today, his backdrop would be like his four gold gloves. And I'd be like, okay, that's pretty good. Like that's better than, you know, like my Kyle Lauer jersey in the background of my home office. So like that, that was a chef's kiss comeback for Vernon Wells.
Yeah, no argument with a Kyle Lowry jersey in the background either. But yeah, so Vernon Wells, I mean, what was it, 2004 and 2006, he had seasons of 13 and 12 defensive runs saved. How good is that? Well, those numbers are better than what Dalton Varsho has right now as a left fielder or as a center fielder. But together, Dalton Varsho, and we'll use the Kiermaier conversation to pivot to Dalton Varsho. Right now, and I'm going to talk about this on Blue Jay Central before the game, so I don't want to spoil all of it, but you and I have joked, like, is he going to win the platinum glove without winning a gold glove? Is he going to, like, there is a legitimate case that I was joking about a few weeks ago that he should win the gold glove in left field and center field, because even though he doesn't have nearly as many innings as anyone else, he's leading the American League in defensive run saves at two positions at once. Are we running out of ways for this man to talk about this, to describe this?
Yeah, to be honest, I've used this a couple times, but like the best way of describing him, like we just spend 5-10 minutes talking about Kevin Kiermaier's defense on a rate basis. So Kiermaier's the GOAT in terms of outfield defensive run saved on a cumulative basis, but on a rate basis, on a per inning basis, there's only one guy better than Kiermaier's in the outfield, and that's his teammate Dalton Varsho. So to me, like, that puts it into context of just how good he is in the outfield. And, you know, we talked about it in our open yesterday down here at the Dome, where, like, it's still kind of unbelievable that this guy's, like, was a catcher in college, like, was, you know, 90% catcher in college. First couple minor league seasons, he was, like, 80% catcher. First couple major league seasons, he was, like, 40 to 50% catcher. So, like, for a guy with that background to now all of a sudden be the best per inning defensive outfielder in baseball, like, again, I really do think he has a pathway. He's going to win one of them in left field or center. I honestly think he has a clear path in left field. Like, I think Duran will challenge him in center. It all depends on what happens with Kiermaier, to be honest.
So this is to explain to people the way that it works is players are only eligible at one position, and it's whichever position you played the most. So right now, Dalton Varsho has played more left field than center field, but it's close. So if Kevin Kiermaier is traded or DFA'd or something like that after the trade deadline, Varsho is going to end up having played more center than left, and then he enters the center field pool. By the way, it's also, there is a manager and six coaches from each team that get to vote. You can't vote on your own players. And then there is also a statistical component that Sabre contributes. So it's not just the straight vote or just the straight numbers. It's a blend of those things. So with respect to Varsho, you know, we're going to see it. Kevin Kiermaier is going to retire at the end of the year. He might not be a Blue Jay pass next Tuesday. Dalton Varsho is going to become a full-time center fielder moving forward. I would imagine if they look at outfield help in the offseason, you know, you could get someone who plays center field, but Dalton Varsho is your center fielder. He's the best center fielder in baseball defensively. When you look at that, and I know you wanted to talk about this, so I it's not me bringing it up to relitigate it necessarily. But when we talk about that trade again, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., whatever, he hit free agency. He signed a 3-year, $42 million deal. So there's a financial component there. He hasn't had that great a season. Gabriel Moreno, in terms of wins above replacement, is if you use Fangraphs WAR, they are both at four. Both Gabriel Moreno and Dalton Varsho are at 4.3 since the trade. Mm-hmm. They're dead even. What did you want to say about kind of recontextualizing that trade or revisiting it again?
Well, I think it's worth revisiting right now, even though it feels like it gets revisited once every couple months, because, you know, this front office is getting reevaluated, and this the trade, it's one of the defining moves, right? And to be honest, like, what I think some of the biggest, like, misconceptions or the things that are kind of being misconstrued about this trade is, like, you mentioned Moreno's wins above replacement. Like, I can't, it's funny how much of that is defensive.
Yeah. I think he's number two. Defense, I think, right? Fangraphs has him at number two among catcher defense.
Like, what is he? He's a 250 hitter with 3 or 4 home runs, right? Like, so that hasn't panned out really for them. Like, he's been good. And I still do think he's going to have a long career because of the defense and because of the bat to ball skills, but he hasn't become some superstar. And I think the postseason from last year is kind of, like, misconstrued how good those guys have been. You know, we spent 5-10 minutes talking about Kevin Kiermaier. Over these last 2 years, Kevin Kiermaier has been more valuable from using either Baseball Reference or Fangraphs than Lourdes Gurriel as an outfielder. Now, again, we talk about offense, defense, all the different components that go into that, but Gurriel hasn't been all that valuable either. His defense is not good. His on-base is, you know, percentage points above Kiermaier's. So I just think it's, you know, Varsho, he would tell you he wishes his offense has been better over the last couple of years, but I think Moreno and Gurriel's production and the value that they've given their new team is vastly overblown by a lot of people still in this market.
Well, I'm always a sucker for a catching prospect, and I think Gabriel Moreno is really, really good. So as I really enjoy Dalton Varsho, I think I'll probably, I mean, we'll see at the end of each of these contracts and the ARB figures get and stuff like that. But right now it feels like a trade. It's pretty close. And Gurriel, I think really, you know, only the 2023 component counts.
That's right.
Because then he signed a 3-year $42 million deal that he wouldn't have signed here anyway. Okay, speaking of trades, the deadline is on Tuesday. How are you feeling generally, and also like as a producer, knowing that a doubleheader Monday and then a trade deadline Tuesday, like we're in full chaos mode for this Orioles series?
I feel sorry for...
Are you not on it?
I don't know. Listen, I work until Sunday and then I pivot to tennis. I'm tennis world. In fact, we have a reporter. We have a reporter today down at tennis who is interviewing some players, getting ready. So it's going to be a lot of fun over the next little week, but no baseball. So it's really, you know, the trade deadline's really interesting. I still believe that, like, it's funny, whenever we hear discussions around this team over the last few days or over the last couple of weeks even, it's like, you know, we can debate about the merits of competing in 2025, and then it moves on, right? Like, and I think it's worth, like, having that debate, right? Like, is it worth? And I, to be honest, like, whether you can call it, you know, is it too optimistic? Like, I fully understand the limitations, but I don't think it's worth moving the playoff, you know, probability, whatever they do after they spend $50 million this offseason or $40 million, whatever it is, you know, whatever that playoff probability is, let's say it's 30%, 33%, 40%. I don't think it's worth going down to 0% or something close to it for whatever the opportunity cost is of, you know, the cost of not moving Bichette right now or not waiting till next year's deadline to move Bichette. Like, whatever that opportunity cost is, I don't think it's worth that huge drop of just punting on 2025.
Well, the way I phrased it earlier is that you can make a case for it, and you, like, you know, people can disagree on whether they should blow it up or not. But if you're talking negotiations, you know, the fact that we have not heard they're untouchable, we have heard that they would have to be, like, blown away to engage on Vlad and Bo, is that to me says, well, here's what a fair deal looks like in a vacuum, but you also have to buy us out of that playoff probability
That's
for
right.
2025.
That's a great
way. There is a chance that we could compete. You have to sell us on, okay, we'll punt on 2025 as well. You got to buy those percentages.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, right? Because no matter what, like, you, again, debating the merits of it and debating how high of a chance they have of competing, like, I think there's fair discussions and debates to have around that. But that's a great way of putting it. Like, how much are you going to pay to get us to move that probability all the way down to close to zero? And, you know, as we all know, like, I think they're incentivized to want to compete. It would take far too many, you know, moves to really tear it down, right? And the feasibility or likelihood of that is really low. And I'm just, Baltimore is stacked. We get it. I want to see them spend before I really buy in. And they might spend in terms of prospect capital. Like, it might be where they spend isn't moving their payroll up to top 10, but it's moving a whole bunch of prospects for Scooble. Like, that might be how they pay. But, you know, I wouldn't be, if you're a team that's in dire need of a cleanup hitter and in dire need of one that, hey, maybe a switch hitting cleanup hitter, like, I would not be against the Blue Jays going after Anthony Santander this offseason. I think that's a great option for the Blue Jays. So, you know, as the added bonus of taking a really good hitter away from a divisional rival, like, again, I just, yeah, there's almost no scenario where they're a 60 to 70% probability team next year. Too many moves they need to make. But to me, it's not worth – I'll take 30 or 40%. I just think it's worth it. And, you know, especially – you know, I heard you earlier talking to Jonah about, you know, is Yariel the biggest thing between now and the end of the year? And I certainly think he's one of the big factors, one of the big storylines to watch. But to me, it's Vladdy. Are we continuing to see a ceiling now that's closer to 2021 than 2022? I think we all kind of viewed it as maybe 2022 was something like the new ceiling. But, you know, I think this year has changed that, you know, maybe it's not all the way back to 2021. But to me, like, that's what I'm watching between now and the end of the year is just how far can Vladdy re-raise his ceiling, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it certainly does. And again, right now, his season stat line is the second best of his career. It's on par with the second half of his 2021 season, which, again, I said earlier, you know, I think that tells you more about the drop off toward the end of that season that maybe told us what was coming, rather than this is an unbelievable year. But he's very close to hitting 300. He's back on pace to almost hit 30 home runs. He's not too far off the pace of 100 RBI. Like, if he ends this year with a 330, 100 slash, like average home run RBI, like, I think everyone feels pretty good. So we've only got about 4 minutes left here, Chris. Are you seeing anything different in this power surge, or is just the continuation? I know Joe has had something with the hand positioning and the way he loads those hands. What have you seen in Vlad's power output here?
To be honest, I think it was just the process of figuring this out over the course of a season. Like, you and I know, we've been on every week. He's probably been our most talked about player this year, him and Bo probably. But I've been bullish on him since early April. I always liked the process. You and I were always talking about, you know, will the power come? And I always did think it would come. I think there's a few things that stand out in July. One is the ground ball rate is way down. So that's always been a thing with Vladdy, we all know. And the other thing that, you know, we'll all, even though he's pulled some home runs, like, the pull rate is down. You know, that home run he hit 2 days ago, that's my favorite type of Vladdy home run. Siddle mentioned it on the broadcast. The two iron low launch to center field that goes 420 feet. You know, there are only so many players in the world who can hit that type of baseball. And to me, that's when he's at his best, is when he's hitting those two irons. And he had, you know, in 2021, when he was at his best, yes, he pulled a lot of baseballs, but, like, there were a lot of those. He had one against Max Scherzer that year that was, like, a little left center, but the same idea, where he's clearing out. And to me, this is just the culmination of a lot of months of hard work. I think the Blue Jays training staff worked really hard with him in the offseason. I think he himself took it upon himself to, like, really work hard at some private facilities as well in the Tampa area. I think he changed his body. That was the first thing that stood out when I saw him in March. That gave me confidence, and, like, this can be what, like, this, what can he bring? Because, again, you mentioned 2021. What stands out, the most common thing people mention about 2021 with Vladdy are the minor league ballparks. To me, what doesn't get mentioned enough is best shape of his life, like, quote unquote cliches, but it really was. That was another year where he really worked hard in the offseason to come into camp ready to go. And to be honest, like, I think this is that's part of what this year is about. So, you know, to me, that's who I'm watching over the next 50 games, 55 games, whatever. Can he continue this insane trajectory?
Can he continue hitting 5 home runs every 6 games? Probably not, but I would love to see it. But yeah, I think, you know, finish this year, hey, you're hitting 300. The slug's back up over 500. You finish with 29, 30, 31 home runs, get close to 100 RBI. You can feel really good about that season heading into next year. Chris Black, thanks so much for doing this. I will see you shortly. I got to book it down to the park after this one. Have a good game.
I will probably be in that dark truck by then. But if I see you, I will say hello.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
See you.
Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, producing the games this series and this weekend as well. You can follow him at Down to Black on Twitter. A lot of very good and informative threads there as well. It is deadline season. We'll talk more trade stuff tomorrow. It's probably all we'll talk about on Monday and Tuesday. Although Monday we have a doubleheader to talk about, and I am a sucker for a doubleheader. I'm a sucker for everything today. Catching prospects, doubleheaders, trade deadline trivia, whatever. Having a nice morning. Yeah, I love doubleheaders. Anyway, this is not a doubleheader. It's a 3 p.m. game. It's a work from dome game. It is Chris Bassett against Taj Bradley. Chris Bassett, three rougher outings the last three, but before that, he'd been very, very good. We've seen him pitch very, very well after a struggle. You know, he started this year not particularly great and then had like the best eight start stretch that we've seen him had as a Blue Jay. He's seen this Rays team twice already. Rough one in the first series of the year. Not bad the next time out. We'll see if he can get to a team that is third to last in Major League Baseball in home runs against right-handed pitching and in lefty home runs against right-handed pitching. Keep an eye out, though, on Brandon Lau, Palacios, Josh Lowe, and Ben Rortvedt. They all hit lefty against righty pretty well. Thank you to Jonah Bierenbaum, to JP Ricciardi, to Chris Black for joining us. Thank you to Andrew Adams, Amit Mon, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Thank you to you guys for texting in as well. We'll be back to talk to you tomorrow at 10 a.m. Have a wonderful Thursday.